infinitely in all directions, changes state, and suddenly a particle is visible. One of the basics in quantum mechanics is that a quantum, for instance, a photon or electron, can behave either like a wave or a particle. No one disputes this. What is disputed is whether the simple act of observation causes the wave function to collapse. On the physicalist side, things are things, period. And claiming that an observer causes a particle to emerge from the quantum field is mysticism, not physics. But the most widely accepted version of quantum mechanics, the Copenhagen interpretation, so named after the work done at the Copenhagen Institute by Danish physicist Niels Bohr, places the observer at the crossroads between wave and particle. This still leaves open the mechanism that allows the act of looking to affect physical matter. Something must be going on under the table, as it were. Observer A looks at object B with the intention of measuring something about it, such as its mass, position, momentum, and so on. The instant this intention is specified, the object complies. That's the under-the-table part. No one has an accepted explanation for it. Heisenberg described this in the most definite terms. What we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning. The observer cannot be separated from the observed, because nature gives us what we want to look for. The whole universe, it seems, is like Lake Wobegon. Now, let's extend the observer problem, which in the Copenhagen interpretation becomes the observer effect, to the mystery of what the universe is made of. If, as Heisenberg said, atoms or elementary particles are themselves not real, then asking what the universe is made of turns out to be the wrong question. We are trying to squeeze juice out of an illusion, and it won't work. The universe is made of what we want it to show us. Physicalists roll their eyes when they hear such an idea. But certain facts are undeniable. No one has ever seen the wave function collapse. It's not an observable event. Whereas calculating the behavior of matter in terms of uncertainty and probabilities has proved spectacularly successful. Quantum objects defy common sense rules of cause and effect. Put these facts together, and the picture that emerges isn't a cosmos full of stuff, but a cosmos full of possibilities mysteriously turning into stuff. The transformation is more real than the physical appearance we take for granted. To date, there is no better answer to what is the universe made of. Even a grumbling physicalist has to concede that the collapse of the wave function is a transformation. Pulling a rabbit out of a hat is an illusion. Pulling a photon out of the field is real. Unfortunately, for the Copenhagen interpretation and all of modern physics, no matter which interpretation one favors, the road stops here. An observer in the laboratory may affect the behavior of a photon, but this is miles away from everyday life. Can looking at the whole universe, its stars and galaxies, or looking at trees, clouds, and mountains actually transform them? The notion sounds preposterous at this point, but in fact, this is the basic claim of the human universe. We aren't there yet. To get around the roadblock, we'll have to prove that mind isn't just one factor in the cosmos, but the factor that underlies how everything in creation behaves. That challenge is looming ever closer, one mystery at a time. Is there design in the universe? Are we living inside a universe with a grand design? This was a hot-button question long before intelligent design sent off alarm bells among the scientific community. Intelligent design is based on trusting the book of Genesis, but if you loosen your criteria and ask, is God playing any part in creation? the same firestorm erupts. Science is anti-design because of its stance on religion. Keep it out of the lab. Politics, don't let churches interfere with government funding. And rationality, there are no data suggesting a grand design driven by God or the gods. A random universe excludes the notion of design. If every event happens by chance, from the emergence of a subatomic particle to the Big Bang, there's no need for a designer to oversee how the cosmos turned out. So why is there any mystery to solve? Because our minds are caught between two worldviews. It's like being trapped in an elevator stuck between two floors. In Rudyard Kipling's children's story, How the Leopard Got Its Spots, the spots were painted on by an Ethiopian hunter so that leopards would blend into the speckly, patchy, blotchy shadows. Modern science agrees. It turns out that cats who hunt in the dark or in dappled forest light are much more likely to have spots or stripes, because these evolved to help the animals hide and hunt for food. Cats that hunt out in the open are more likely to have plain, undecorated coats. There's always an exception to the rule, so we get the cheetah, which runs after its prey out in the open, but is also spotted. It would seem that Kipling and an evolutionary biologist might have come up with the same answer, only they didn't. In place of Ethiopian hunter, put the words God or Mother Nature or whatever designer you like. In the form of a whimsical tale for children, Kipling adheres to the worldview that gives the leopard its spots for a reason, and this reason is known in advance. Camouflage. This worldview doesn't specifically need God, just a creative reason for leopards to have spots. The Ethiopian hunter didn't paint the leopard bright orange, because that would have defeated the whole point. Science puts the reason afterward, as the effect, not the cause. Leopards got their spots at random, due to the interaction of two specific chemicals known as morphogens. These chemicals create all patterns, including the ridges your tongue can feel on the roof of your mouth. Through a random mutation involving morphogens and how they interact, spots emerged on a cat long, long ago, and it turned out to work as camouflage. The animal doesn't know that it's camouflaged. It doesn't know anything about how it looks. The only thing that matters in Darwinism is survival, and a cat with spots survives better by being a better hunter in dappled light. The patterns of spots and stripes on cats in the wild are random also, and their arrangement was predicted using a computer model by World War II British codebreaker Alan Turing. Why, then, are we stuck between worldviews like an elevator stuck between floors? Because in our minds, there's a reason for leopards to have spots, just as Kipling said. But at the same time, we accept the mechanism behind the spots, just as science says. It is very hard to get the human mind to accept that absolutely everything in nature is meaningless. But that's what Darwinism, the Big Bang, cosmic inflation, and the formation of the solar system are all about. Stripping creation of human notions like purpose and meaning. Scientists hate the word design because it feels like a sneak attack from a worldview they thought was extinct. But if you forget the current hot-button climate of opinion, the words design, pattern, structure, and form are synonyms. There is no rational reason why design should be considered especially radioactive. But we have to be realistic. Words have histories, and the history of design is repugnant to many scientists because of its association with creationism. The creationist campaign updates the Book of Genesis by claiming that science supports the notion of intelligent design. Alarmists on the opposite side view this as a threat to the integrity of science. In reality, intelligent design has appealed mostly to the faithful and to the mass media, who knew an entertaining story when they saw one. The courts have thrown out any attempt to give creationism equal time in school curriculums with science, although a few exceptions linger, unfortunately. It would seem foolhardy to plow this field again. But that stuck elevator won't budge. Looking around at nature, we see design everywhere. Is this just a trick of the mind? No one catches bears and frogs staring with wonder at a rainbow. For them, there is no beautiful iridescent arc. In fact, no pattern at all. Accounting for the beauty of a rainbow may be a red herring. Perhaps we should be asking a totally cold-blooded question. Is anything in the universe there by design? Grasping the mystery. Despite their belief in randomness, scientists regularly refer to the structure of the atom. Spiral nebulae form a recognizable pattern that one can harmlessly call a design. And with this in mind, the whole messy issue of design, pattern, form, structure can be clarified as follows. The universe owes its existence to the emergence of order from chaos. The wrestling match between form and the formless is still with us throughout the universe. Modern physics is based on random processes devoid of purpose and meaning. We don't ask a question like, what does gravity mean on Jupiter? And yet human life, including the pursuit of science, has purpose and meaning. Where did those come from? Without a doubt, the language of mathematics exhibits every quality of design. Balance, harmony, symmetry, and some would say, beauty. In Chinese calligraphy, the ability to draw a perfect circle with one stroke of the brush is the mark of a master, and art connoisseurs see beauty in the achievement. Electrons, at least for the lowest orbits, travel in a perfect circle around the nucleus of an atom. Isn't that a beautiful design, too? The following are all examples of helixes, or spirals, in nature. The shell of a chambered nautilus, the pattern of seeds in a sunflower, and the structure of DNA. Which ones qualify as a design? Some? All? Or none? A science that depends totally on randomness to explain the universe falls far short. Inside the rational activity of science, there is still much to argue over, because intelligence and design are tangled in the same ball of yarn that makes the universe so mysterious. We'll try to unravel the snarl without any agenda, but this will take the exposure of some hidden agendas along the way. We accept Bohr and Heisenberg's insight, which was quite brilliant, that nature displays the properties an observer happens to be looking for. This notion certainly pertains to design. Nothing about a rose, the rich crimson color, the velvety texture or sharp thorn, the sumptuous fragrance, exists without an observer. Yet your mind can hold a gorgeous red rose in full bloom because the human brain transforms or translates raw data into sight, sound, touch, taste, and smell. There isn't even any light in the world without someone to see it, because photons have no brightness on their own. Deep within the pitch-black recesses of the visual cortex, purely chemical and electrical impulses traveling along the optic nerve are transformed into light. The fact that the brain is totally dark while the world is full of light could be called the mystery of mysteries, and we're not quite ready to tackle that one yet. For the moment, we'll stay with the tie that binds observer and observed. If it takes the brain to process the raw material of nature and turn it into a beautiful red rose, is the same processing also creating design? Clearly the answer is yes. When a caterpillar is chewing on a rose, it can destroy its beauty in an hour. But the beauty of the rose that the caterpillar takes away was put there by human beings. To an insect that preys on roses, A flower is just food. It's not really the brain that creates beauty, but the mind. Someone who is violently allergic to roses might consider them too great a nuisance to be beautiful. Such a person presumably has the same brain mechanisms as Pierre-Joseph Redouté, a famous painter of roses during the time of Napoleon. But their mindset isn't the same. And if roses are beautiful only because the human mind finds beauty in them, does the same hold true for the entire cosmos? Putting the question this way seems innocent enough, but it has explosive implications. One camp that gets particularly agitated is known as naive realism. In scientific arguments, the naive realists are the great defenders of common sense, using reality as it is given to buttress their position. The word naive isn't meant to be pejorative. It's just the opposite of overthinking. Here are two givens that apply to the human brain, for example. Every thought is accompanied by the firing of neurons. Many thoughts contain information, such as 1 plus 1 equals 2. No one would dispute these facts, and according to naive realists, observing neural activity on a brain scan is enough to tell you that the brain creates the mind, that the brain is basically a computer made of meat, to use an unlovely description that is popular in the field of artificial intelligence, and that every enigma posed by the brain can be solved by examining its physical structure and operation. At a guess, 90% of neuroscientists and an even higher percentage of researchers in artificial intelligence, AI, believe in these ideas. Therefore, you can see the power of naive realism. Yet from another angle, AI is making an obvious mistake. When you ask your computer to translate a page of German into English, a translator program can do it almost instantly. Does this mean that your computer knows German? Of course not. The artificial imitation of thinking isn't the real thing. The translator program does its job by matching words and phrases to a dictionary. Someone who knows German doesn't do this at all. Thinking requires a mind, period. Even though two facts about the brain are true, to say that the brain creates the mind and that computers and brains are the same isn't automatically true. These are simply assumptions, and naive realism is full of other assumptions that get accepted without being examined.